April 8, 1991, 1 p.m., Hearing Room 357, House Committee on Judiciary, Subcommittee on Civil Law and Judicial Administration.
On Judiciary, Subcommittee on Civil Law and Judicial Administration. We're going to go ahead and take public testimony on House Bill 2832, excuse me, and ask Mr. Anderson if he would mind. I understand Mr. Anderson needs to be back in Eugene, and we're sorry about the half-hour delay in our normal meeting time, but we didn't get out of floor session until after 12:30 today. So, any case, we're sorry to keep you, but the same token, maybe you can tell us what you need to and still get back in time for work.
Thank you, Representative Baum. I do have a summary judgment argument in federal court this afternoon, which was reset at the judge's own motion last week till this afternoon. So I'm up until last Thursday, I didn't think that I had this conflict, so I appreciate it.
Why don't you go ahead and get into your testimony? Normally we have staff explain the measure, but maybe your testimony probably would and save us time, okay, and you can get on your way.
This is a fairly short, fairly simple bill, House Bill 2382, basically just a page long, a page and a few lines. I will go through my testimony, in some places summarize, and other places go through it pretty much as in its prepared form. My name is Bruce Anderson, and I am an attorney in private practice with the law firm of Hutchison, Anderson, Cox, Parrish, and Coons, P.C. in Eugene. I'm also a member of the Executive Committee of the International Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. I'm testifying in my position as a member of the Executive Committee and on behalf of the section's support for House Bill 2382, the Uniform Transboundary Pollution Reciprocal Access Act. You should note that this act was originally drafted and proposed by both the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws of the United States and its Canadian counterpart, the Uniform Law Conference of Canada. The international law section of the bar is made up of attorneys who spend some substantial part of their time in practice dealing with either private or public law issues in international law or both. A great number of these attorneys are attorneys like myself who represent clients involved in international business transactions as part of their normal business law practice. I practiced law for 24 years. There are three major issues, three major points that I'd like to make in support of this legislation. The first one, and I think the most critical, is what this legislation is not as well as what it is. To begin with, it applies only to pollution originating in Oregon and to pollution-based remedies, not to other types of claims. It gives no jurisdiction, in other words, it does not deal with jurisdiction in any way with it for any other types of claims. In addition, even if the pollution-only area is met, House Bill 2382 grants no jurisdiction to an Oregon court over the claim of a non-resident for pollution-based injury unless the state, territory, province, or possession of the plaintiff's residence has adopted a substantially similar statute. That's the most important thing about understanding the limitations of this law. It does absolutely nothing unless the foreign state, the foreign forum, whether it's a Canadian province or territory or a U.S. state, adopts the same or substantially similar legislation there to implement it and to give an Oregon resident in that locale the same benefits that this would give to an out-of-state resident who is injured in a foreign locale from pollution that originates in Oregon. So it is completely reciprocal and only reciprocal in that sense. There is nothing granted by this legislation to the out-of-state plaintiff who doesn't have the same legislation in place in her or his state. HB 2382 is thus works to allow someone who suffers injury or threatened injury to person or property in what I will call the foreign state for the rest of my testimony. That's basically another state or territory or possession of the United States, Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, or a province or territory of Canada. It allows a resident then of this one of these locales, which are, as I said, called a foreign state, as a result of pollution originating in the state of Oregon, to sue in Oregon as respects such injury based on the jurisdiction granted by this statute, if but only if the foreign state has adopted substantially similar statute to HB 2382. In other words, if the place of the plaintiff's residence would allow an Oregon resident injured by pollution originating in the foreign state to sue the defendant in that foreign state for a pollution-based injury that winds up occurring in Oregon, then that person can seek relief in Oregon for pollution-based injury occurring in the foreign state but caused by pollution coming from Oregon.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bell.
Could I ask you to give an example? I'm having a little trouble following what you mean by what type of pollution and how that would actually occur.
If, for example, on the Oregon side, if British Columbia were to adopt a similar statute, pollution were to originate in British Columbia, come down the Columbia River, and injure a person here in Oregon, even though, for reasons I'll get to later in my testimony, our long-arm statute, if that is an isolated individual in particular rather than a multinational corporation, our long-arm statute would not grant jurisdiction to an Oregon court over that foreign defendant. If this statute were present in British Columbia and in Oregon, an Oregon resident could go to British Columbia and sue there for injury to their person and to their Oregon property, even though normally that would not be the case, especially as to property. The reverse would be the true, too. It's hard to use the Columbia River in reverse because the pollution isn't going to flow north, but if some pollution originating in Oregon injured a person in Canada, they could then come to Oregon and sue for those remedies, even if it involved damage to property in Canada. They could sue under this statute. If Oregon has the statute, and if British Columbia has the statute.
Is that something that's going on now, is all the statutes in the states?
We're trying to get states and provinces in Canada to adopt these statutes. No one who adopts it gives up anything jurisdictionally except to a state or province that adopts a similar statute.
Why don't you go ahead and hit point two? We're all pretty well trained on reading, so okay. Hit the high points if you will.
All right. If a foreign plaintiff comes to Oregon to sue based on the jurisdiction granted by this act, another thing you need to be aware of is that they don't get to choose the law, basically. The statute makes clear that they have to apply Oregon law, excluding Oregon's choice of law rules. So it's basically only Oregon law if they come to this state based on the jurisdiction granted by this statute to sue here in Oregon. In addition, the Act makes clear that the foreign plaintiff will not receive in Oregon any rights superior to those that the foreign plaintiff would have received had the injury from the Oregon source occurred in Oregon. That brings me to the third point, and that is the question, well, why do we need this legislation? I think the first point, which I'll just summarize, is obviously we all understand that pollution is not a respecter of artificial lines on a map. We've had in many recent cases in very recent years involving such things as acid rain, riverborne pollution, chemical drift by winds, and so on, where you'll have multi-state pollution involved or multinational pollution involved. That's become part of our life in more recent years, and it wasn't 50 or 100 years ago, but it's certainly becoming part of our life today. The traditional rule, however, in both American and Canadian jurisprudence is that actions for damages for this type of pollution or for injunctions to abate or limit it, where the injury occurs to real property in another jurisdiction, can only be brought in the state where the property is located. That's one of the problems that this legislation would overcome. The result of this rule is that an Oregonian whose property is damaged, for example, by water-based pollution originating in Canada, has to sue in Oregon. But the problem then is, how does an Oregon court achieve personal jurisdiction over the Canadian defendant who has no presence in or contacts with Oregon? Now, I'm going to really summarize here in considerable detail, but what I have attempted to do and what I've done in this testimony is to compare Oregon's long-arm statutes and to tell you why, in our judgment, they do not completely fill the hole for pollution-based injuries to grant personal jurisdiction over non-resident defendants for injuries occurring in their state. We don't agree that they do that, and in fact, they don't do that in most states, and that's why the Uniform Conference Commissioners have proposed this particular bill. The reason that you need to understand why they don't do that is sort of severalfold. Number one, there's no Oregon case in point interpreting our long-arm jurisdictional statutes where the person or property of an Oregon resident is injured by pollution that enters Oregon from a foreign state. We have to look to U.S. Supreme Court cases interpreting analogous long-arm statutes from other states. And even there, we only find cases dealing with standard items of interstate commerce, not interstate pollution. That's the most fundamental thing to understand. Even our U.S. Supreme Court precedents deal with standard products and commerce issues under long-arm clauses, and they don't deal with international or multi-state pollution from a long-arm statute standpoint. So what can we safely conclude if we do look at those cases? Number one, that personal jurisdiction can be obtained by a foreign state over a non-resident defendant who has no actual presence in that state if the defendant has purposefully directed his or her or its activities at the citizen of the foreign state. But the mere likelihood that the defendant's product will find its way into the foreign state in normal commerce is insufficient to establish jurisdiction. Secondly, that proof of the defendant's awareness that the stream of commerce may or will sweep defendant's product into the foreign state does not convert the mere act of placing the product into the stream of commerce into an act purposefully directed towards the foreign state. Even where there has been an attempt to find general jurisdiction over non-resident defendants based on contacts with a foreign state that are not related to the subject of the lawsuit itself, our U.S. Supreme Court has not allowed long-arm jurisdiction to attach, even in the presence of substantial number of direct contacts by the defendant with the foreign state. I've cited the key United States Supreme Court cases on this issue. The problem then becomes that the only safe conclusion from the available U.S. Supreme Court cases, none of which apply the purposefully directed test in a pollution context, is that Oregon's long-arm statute may very well not grant an Oregon court jurisdiction over a non-resident defendant polluter whose pollution causes injury in Oregon to an Oregon resident or to that resident's property. Imagine the example that I was talking about a minute ago, if you would, because that really poses that setting to the greatest extent. Somebody's in Canada. They have no substantial connection with Oregon in any way. They don't do business here in any fashion. They're not a multi-state or international corporation. They cause something to enter the Columbia River, and that pollutant comes to Oregon and causes injury here. Oregon's long-arm statute under those circumstances can probably not be constitutionally interpreted to allow an Oregon court to have jurisdiction over that pollution. Thus, unless you can go to Canada and get both personal and property damage jurisdiction in Canada, you're not going to be able to get a remedy for that. That's what this statute is designed to deal with. And again, it will only deal with it if a Canadian province adopts the same or substantially similar statute to give Oregon residents that access. We're not giving a Canadian resident Oregon access to Oregon courts for jurisdictional purposes unless the Canadian province or territory gives the same access to Oregon by adopting a similar statute. So you adopt this statute, the state of Oregon adopts it, British Columbia doesn't get around for 2 years to adopting a statute, there's no jurisdiction granted to Canadian citizen pursuant to this statute in the meantime, none, zero. Only when British Columbia or another state, it applies the same way to any other state, the same rule applies, you have to adopt that similar statute there before a resident of that state can come to Oregon and sue and claim jurisdiction under this statute. They cannot do it, the Act is very clear on that point, unless their forum where they come from, their place of residence, has adopted the same or substantially similar statute, which would benefit an Oregonian then in reverse. You might ask why an Oregon plaintiff simply couldn't go to Canada and sue under the present circumstances without this statute. And the answer is because in the absence of the statute, the Canadian court could not grant complete relief. I've cited the primary Canadian case on that point and the Oregon equivalent. Oregon has an equivalent too, and that relates to the question of if you have property damage, you normally can only sue in the state where the property is located to obtain relief. These points and these authorities concerning Canadian law and practice are all well supported by the prefatory note and related commentary from the Uniform Law Conference of Canada when it adopted the equivalent of HB 2382 and recommended the same for adoption by the various provinces and territories of Canada. I've attached that commentary and prefatory note to my testimony, also a letter from the Honorable Basil Stapleton, who is the president of the Uniform Law Conference of Canada, to Jerry Barton, who is the chair of our international law section here in Oregon of the Executive Committee of the section, making very clear why and how Canadian courts will not enforce U.S. judgments as a matter of course, absent this particular type of legislation.
Now, what you can do is we can probably read your conclusion, and we're going to probably move favorably on this legislation. It might be not be why you're here, but we got the message, I think, and I don't see anybody in opposition to the bill. So if you wouldn't mind, we can read your conclusion.
Fine. Thank you. I appreciate
you can,
that.
And you're on your way to back to...
Again, I just close by saying I think you're from your action, you're correct in understanding that you're not giving anything here unless you receive something somewhere else. Nothing happens pursuant to this bill unless another state or territory adopts the same legislation.
A couple of questions. Representative Johnson and Representative Bryan.
As a practical matter, given the flows of water from the north, both down the Columbia and the Pacific drift, I think, is from north to south along our coast. As a practical matter, what are the odds of anybody in Oregon ever causing any pollution in Canada?
Well, I think as you get closer to the border, it's much more common that that could happen for local wind drift, chemical purposes or otherwise, that could happen. In terms of the major pollution, like what we saw happen on the Ohio River twice within the last 5 years, that's much more apt to affect Oregonians, no doubt about that, just because of the way the river flows. But this doesn't just apply in Canada. That's the important point. We want other states to adopt this, too, so the same thing would apply to an incident on the Idaho-Oregon border, for example, where somebody who you couldn't reach by long-arm jurisdiction caused an injury either in Oregon or vice versa. This act is jurisdictionally neutral in that sense. It says you adopt this statute, Oregon adopts this statute, then you each have access to make sure you have a remedy for the wrong.
I'm just trying to get a picture. I mean, I assume you've done some thinking about where the natural flows are. I mean, we've got, the Klamath goes into California and the prevailing winds go from Oregon to Idaho. I mean, I'm just trying to get a picture of how this would apply. It seems like given the natural forces on Oregon, we're likely to be the recipient, more likely to be the recipient of pollution than the giver of pollution.
I think in terms of major pollution, you're correct. Major incidents of pollution, the type of Ohio River problem, for example, we would be the ones who would be suffering from it,
right,
and would benefit from this.
So if that's true, then that gives us all the more impetus to pass this bill so we can do something about it.
I agree.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that touches on the question I was going to ask about the balance of interests. Whether in broad terms Oregon is likely to be advantaged versus having our businesses and so forth disadvantaged by this bill.
Again, I think if this was an implementing piece of legislation that unilaterally granted jurisdiction for pollution claims, those questions would be even stronger and I think need to be really weighed heavily, but that's not what this bill will do. It will require to get a benefit from wherever the benefit comes from, that the forum state for that plaintiff have adopted the same legislation. I think that the Representative Johnson's point is correct in terms of major sources of pollution. Oregon is liable to benefit more from other states or provinces adopting this type of legislation because then its residents could get relief that they would otherwise not have. But I'm not suggesting that there's no circumstance where somebody in Idaho or Washington or someone wouldn't be injured and get an opportunity to seek relief that they wouldn't have without this bill, assuming their state adopted the same statute.
Ed Bryan.
Now, is this unilateral up and as long as we have that right of reciprocity of our other states?
Yeah.
Unilateral, excuse me. We pass the bill. Does Oregon have this right even though, say, Washington hasn't passed the bill, or need both states act?
Both states have
before
to.
Before either state has
right.
standing.
Right. That's why we're trying around the country to get all states and Canadian provinces to adopt this law, because wherever it's not adopted, nothing happens either way.
Right.
If Idaho doesn't adopt this, then neither Idaho or Oregon residents are going to benefit from Oregon's adoption of this. It's just going to sit there and not implement it, basically.
I think, actually, you've covered a couple of points. One was that we're talking about not just Canada. You kept talking about Canada. You're talking about any adjoining territory or
right.
jurisdiction, and theoretically any territory that enacts this act, and you've already talked about the reciprocity. I just want to commend you for having prepared comprehensive written remarks, which actually will help this bill, I hope, sail through this subcommittee, because did a very nice job of laying everything out, and I appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, committee members, for your information so far, the Canadian provinces, British Columbia, Manitoba, and Prince Frederick Island, as well as Minnesota, Colorado, Wisconsin, Michigan, and New Jersey, have passed similar legislation. I believe that's correct.
Representative Bell.
I had a question when you said limits to pollution. Does that include waste products that are being transported from across boundary lines?
It limits it to pollution as defined by the law of the state where the action is brought. So it would be pollution if somebody came into this state and brought suit here seeking damages or injunction against pollution. We go under Oregon law to define pollution.
How do we define it?
We define it differently for different purposes. It is possible that waste products could be defined under that term because of one statute that I can think of, but for most purposes, it's limited to direct air and water processes, not processed waste, containerized waste. But it's up to that person would get no remedy unless Oregon defined that as pollution. Just like an Oregon resident going to British Columbia would get no remedy for what they allege is pollution-based damage unless British Columbia law defines the particular damage as caused by pollution.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson, appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 23. Oh, we're going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 2382. Open up the public hearing on House Bill 3199. Representative Walden.
Deal with the murder.
Deal with which?
Merlin
How to dissect nonprofit corporations.
Yes, the Merlin. Now famous. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for scheduling this hearing on House Bill 3199. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you. For the record, my name is Greg Walden, and I represent the people of Gilliam, Hood River, Sherman, Wasco, and Wheeler counties in the Oregon House Representatives. I've introduced this measure at the request of Barbara Briggs, Executive Director of the Columbia Gorge Center in Hood River. The Columbia Gorge Center is a private, nonprofit corporation that provides employment, training, and residential services to disabled adults. The Columbia Gorge Center is, frankly, a wonderful facility that enjoys the wholehearted support of the community. And, of course, these are the sorts of standards we should be aiming for in these programs. Without some sort of limit on the tort liability of nonprofit providers of these sorts of services, many will not be able to afford to provide the services that they do, let alone to expand in order to assist in the downsizing efforts that this state is engaged in. The Fairview downsizing proposals a couple of years ago provides an example. The Columbia Gorge Center Board advised against bringing Fairview residents back to the community and into its program because they feared the potential of liability problems that could very well have shut them down. Even as it is now, a separate corporation had to be formed just to handle expansion of services in the Mid-Columbia. On behalf of the many volunteers and the professional staff, I urge your support of this measure to mitigate the threat of liability problems which hang over their heads. These dedicated individuals are indeed providing a service, a tremendous service to our communities, and this legislation would go a long ways in making sure they can continue to provide that support. I might mention that as we wrestle with ballot measure 5 and its implications, this facility and others like it are looking at rather large cutbacks potentially in the funding they will get from the state to do this kind of work. And I think whatever we can do within reasonable bounds to assist them in holding their costs down will accrue benefit both to the state and certainly to the clients who are serviced by them. Mrs. Briggs is here today along with some others from the Oregon Rehabilitation Association, and I know they would like to testify and have some specific concerns and examples.
Questions of Representative Walden?
Representative Walden, I haven't had the opportunity to review the public tort law in detail lately, but it seems to me that there's, at least in the case law and maybe in the statutes, there's a distinction between a liability that a public body has for ministerial acts versus administrative acts. And I just throw this out as a topic, maybe.
Decision.
Yeah, discretionary, is that what it is? Yeah. Anyway, essentially it says that if there's, take a city, for example, if there's a decision by the city council to build a road over here as opposed to building a road over here, the people over here can't sue the city for deciding to build a road over here instead of here, because cities just have to make those kinds of decisions. On the other hand, if some employee, negligently stuck a shovel through somebody's foot, that doesn't raise that level, so there is liability there. I just want to get a handle on the kind of protection you intend to give to these kinds of corporations by just simply making them public bodies for the Public Body Tort Act.
Well, I think it's important to recognize the type of people they're serving, most of whom have emotional or mental or physical handicaps, and so sometimes are at risk of causing a bit of a problem here or there. And I think it's one of those decisions we have to make as to trying to balance that risk against putting one of these centers basically out of business, as one suit could do. And so I think there's what we're proposing is just a limitation on that sort of liability.
Now,
you're posing more of almost a legal question, and I don't know if Representative Walden is in a position to
answer that. The thing I'm worried about, I like the intent of the bill. I'm just worried that it seems to me like there was even a case that I read researching in a case I handled a couple years ago that a state hospital employee had a decision to whether or not to let a person go on parole on leave or whatever, and this mental patient caused some damage to somebody. I think that state employee had some liability for that decision, or at least conceivably could if he was negligent in making that decision. And I think, isn't that the kind of thing that you'd like these people to not be liable for? I'm just trying to get a feel for what he was aiming at when he drew this.
First of all, I think it's important to know that they're not dealing with a criminal element here at all. They're dealing with people who have some emotional difficulties, physical, mental, as I say. And I'm just trying to figure out a way to assist them to be able to provide those sorts of services, recognizing that even if they're under the limitations of the state, there's still a penalty that they would have to pay. But they run into, I think you'll find in the testimony that will be presented, and certainly they can be more specific about the specific problems they have, but into difficulty, again, trying to find insurance providers that will even cover them. And when they do, there's very little competition for the insurance, so the price tends to be high. And then you've got the exposure for the members, volunteer members on the boards of directors, and sure they can have that kind of liability insurance. But again, you're talking organizations in many instances that really run on a shoestring, yet do the kind of service that we're asking them to do. They're paid for by the state. They're dictated on their requirements by the state. And in effect are not under direct control, I realize, but certainly under pretty close supervision in terms of inspections and everything else.
Maybe you ask Barbara Briggs to come up while you're sitting there.
Sure.
Would she mind coming up?
I don't believe she's legal counsel either, but we would defer to the committee clerk can probably take care of that.
Yeah, Representative Emerson has a question.
Greg, Representative Johnson's now confused me, as he frequently does.
Thank you, Jim. He does
that on purpose, I might add. Are you trying to, are you getting at injuries to that might be, not just property, I'm not talking about property damage now, just personal injuries of the people who are in the homes, I mean, the patients who are in the homes, are talking about to the public if a patient escapes and wrecks the downtown Hood River or someplace.
These aren't.
I just want to know who are we trying to get at here? Because if it's the patients in the homes, that seems like one policy question about what sort of protection do they have in these facilities, or are we talking about the potential liability to the public?
Okay, I'll let Barbara speak to that. I just want to, before I do though, make something clear that when you talk about patients escaping, I think that's a misnomer in that most of these people who work in these centers, frankly, live in group homes and come and go often on their own. And so it's not the concept that they're somehow incarcerated, I guess.
Mr. Chair, you made the mention of these folks being mentally and emotionally disturbed and how they can get in trouble. And they can, that's what got me thinking. Maybe we're concerned that...
This isn't a forensics unit.
Well, I understand that, but it includes specifically mentally disturbed, mentally and developmentally disabled, mentally retarded. These are the words in the bill.
Yeah.
So we're talking about folks of at least immediate diminished capacity and perhaps permanently diminished capacity, and who may not be competent for their own actions.